was totally out of the blue. It was just came an email saying, this is it. This is the new draft.
Members of the public and state biologists are questioning a new state approach to land management. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a rally at AFN to free the so-called Fairbanks Four accused of murder.
We have to do it in a good way. We do it in a loving way, in a good way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
If you take a walk through the wetlands around Gustavus in the fall, it's hard to hear yourself over this noise. That's the sound of thousands of sandhill cranes. The Dude Creek Critical Habitat Area is an important resting place on their migration route. The rest of the year, the reserve doesn't look like much. It's a soggy parcel of land just outside of town. But it's special to the small community, which asked the state to protect the area 25 years ago. Now the cranes aren't the only thing causing a fuss at Dude Creek. The wetlands have become an unlikely battleground in a fight that could decide how millions of acres of sensitive land in the state are managed. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has the story.
In the same way that pet owners start to resemble their dogs, Hank Lentfer kind of looks like a sandhill crane. He's a bit gangly and angular with sharp eyes. For most of his adult life, Lentfer has been in love with the bird population and its habitat in Gustavus.
I first came here as a high school student with a biology class from Juneau.
That was in 1983. Now, Lentfer lives in Gustavus year-round. He's a steward for the Nature Conservancy, and he has a spot on an advisory group for some state habitat in Gustavus. The team's job is to give input on how to manage the Dude Creek Critical Habitat Area to best protect the sandhill cranes that feed there during their migration. Here's how the planning process is supposed to go. The Department of Fish and Game's Habitat Division sits down with stakeholders, and they go back and forth on what rules should apply to the land. Once division staff, state biologists, the Fish and Game Commissioner, and ideally local residents are satisfied with what comes out of the meetings, the rules are then turned into state regulations. Lentfer says it had been a collaborative process until this year.
It was amazingly non-controversial.
The Habitat Division issued their first draft in 2011, and it was pretty standard. In tone and level of strictness, it didn't deviate much from the state's other management plans. The new version that was issued this May did. A lot.
It was totally out of the blue. It was just came an email saying, this is it. This is the new draft. Radically different from the ones that not only the planning team members had signed off on, but all the members of the community that had been given a formal opportunity to comment. All those comments had been very thoughtfully summarized and included in that plan. And that's all been gutted.
The management plan had been cut in half and was covered in red edits. Whole sections on scientific research and local knowledge had been stripped. When it came to things like geological exploration or hazardous waste disposal, phrases like will not allow were replaced with may allow. Everything that was prohibited before could now be permitted on a case-by-case basis and without public notice. Dude Creek is not desirable land for development. The ground beneath it is made of clay, and it's hard to imagine any resource extraction or even building construction happening there. The most high-stake issue the planning team had been dealing with was whether to allow four-wheelers. Alaska is full of controversial protected areas. Susitna Flats, where there's a nearby mining project, Kachemak Bay, where there are jackup drill rigs, Bristol Bay, where there are productive salmon streams. But Dude Creek's just not one of them. Lentfer says it felt like the state went from working with the community to working against it.
It seems ironic that a plan developed in such strong collaboration with local people is being taken apart by the very state government that is trying to wiggle free from federal control.
To find out why these changes were made, I talked to Randy Bates.
I'm the director of Habitat.
Before joining Fish and Game, Bates directed the now-defunct Coastal Zone program for the Department of Natural Resources. He's got plenty of experience in land management issues. So it's not a surprise to him that this new plan from Habitat has put Gustavus residents on edge.
There's a lot of red ink in this draft, and I think it's created a lot of public angst over what we're doing here.
Over the course of 2 hours, Bates walks me through the draft. During our conversation, he distances himself from the process.
I didn't have a hand in the redlining of this.
Bates' explanation for what happened is he gave staff his vision, and they went overboard. Still, there's one principle he stands by when it comes to any sort of human activity.
The idea is, can we get to yes instead of can we justify no?
Bates says that because technology and even the land itself can change, he wants to move away from hard restrictions on land use that could block development decades from now. Instead of denying activity outright, he wants biologists to look at a permit application and ask,
is that oil and gas exploration activity or placer mining operation or gravel extraction operation, is that going to prohibit the use of that area by the cranes or the moose or the fish, the reason for its designation? If it is, Habitat's first desire is to modify the project.
The changes made to the Dude Creek plan aren't just about Dude Creek. Habitat manages 32 special areas that stretch from the Bristol Bay region up to the interior and then down to southeast. That's 3 million acres of land that the state set aside for ecological reasons. Only about half of the management plans for these areas have been completed. Dude Creek happened to be the one that Habitat staff was working on when Bates called for a new approach to management. And he says that yes, some of this language is precedent setting.
The concept of these changes was unfairly foisted upon Dude Creek. Dude Creek is, I even talked to our regional soup and said, what kind of activities do you expect to occur out there? Randy, I don't expect to see much in the next 20 years. There's probably not a lot going on. We're going to see four-wheelers. We're going to see tree stands or wildlife viewing platforms. And that's what we're going to see. We're not going to see oil and gas operations. We're not going to see miners out there. So the concept of these changes has really affected a very small, focused plan, and it's really raised a stir. If we were to implement this on the Susitna Flats or the Readout Bay or Ketchumek Bay, it would have been the same sort of blow-up, but this is much ado about nothing in this plan in many ways. It affects these other plans probably to a much greater extent, and they were just probably mischaracterized or misunderstood as they came out.
Part of why Lentfer and other Gustavus residents are troubled by this new approach is that it's coming at the same time the Parnell administration is making an aggressive push to reform permitting. One of the governor's big priorities is a bill that sets a higher bar for appealing a permitting decision and makes it easier for the state to issue general permits that don't need public notice. The idea is to shrink a permitting backlog while encouraging development. But conservation groups describe the policy as an effort to limit public involvement on management decisions. Bates says Habitat's new permitting strategy has nothing to do with that.
We're not changing the planning process to exclude the public and just notify them. We still have every intention to run the process the way it was, soliciting input, sitting down, understanding the concerns. We're not cutting anybody out of this process.
But internal Fish and Game documents obtained by APRN contradict that statement and show even more drastic changes ahead. As of this month, work on all new management plans, including Dude Creek, has been put on hold. Instead, Habitat has been directed to revise all completed management plans in the Dude Creek style. Rather than go through the old process, which involved public scoping meetings, collaborative interagency planning teams, and a series of comment periods, Habitat will put multiple plans into one big regulatory review packet that will go out for comment once a year. According to an email Bates sent to the division, staff cannot discuss the management changes with the public without getting his approval. Even when talking with other fish and game workers, they are required to report that communication, and there are restrictions on what they can say. Sources within the department characterize it as a gag order. The documents also show internal strife within the division. During a May meeting, a regional supervisor asks if the new planning approach is putting federal funding for two staff positions at risk, since they aren't fully complying with requirements about public and agency engagement. In a July meeting, a staff member notes that the overhaul to the management plan process doesn't just cut out public input, it overrides language agreed to by state biologists. In emails, staff question the direction to mark any document that isn't explicitly public as privileged and confidential, which means someone would have to sue to get them released. Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell says the friction between Habitat staff and its leadership may be due to an internal misunderstanding of the new policies. The changes are in response to an order from the governor to make regulations more efficient, and that there's no attempt to limit public involvement. It's hard to think of Dude Creek as some politically fraught place when you're actually standing in the Crane Flats. I'm with Morgan DeBeer, who represented the city of Gustavus on the planning team. DeBeer helped work through some of the original questions on snow machines and hunting accessibility. He jokes that their original plan wasn't terribly strict, even with the cranes themselves.
You can still shoot them over there. I mean, it's just their habitat that we're protecting.
DeBeer's got more of a claim on the land than most. In the history of Gustavus, only a couple of families tried to homestead in those meadows, and they didn't have any success.
The first party back in the 30s was an aunt of mine, and her nickname was Dude. And that's why it's called Dude's Creek.
DeBeer is kind of a dude himself. He comes from a line of prospectors, and he makes his living by operating a sawmill, a few cabins, and a 9-hole golf course that is fertilized with goose droppings. While we're out on the Crane Flats, we talk about the planning process. The changes make him nervous. DeBeer is not worried about the near term, because the land is so inhospitable to development. There haven't been many user conflicts over the years, even without a formal management plan in place.
But if there isn't one, and if it's not a real solid one with good teeth to it, then you are open for some problems down the line, is the way I see it.
Plus, he thinks it's important for locals to shape whatever document comes out, since they're the ones who have to live with the outcome. As he's telling me about the Crane Flats, I realize DeBeer is kind of a funny advocate for them. The sort of things his ancestors did, homesteading, mining for gold, are exactly the kinds of activity that would be prohibited with a stricter management approach. But at the same time, DeBeer's position makes sense. His family ended up settling in Alaska to establish a life under their own rules.
Yeah, you want to determine your own destiny.
We finish talking and spend a few minutes listening to the wind. When we leave the flats, I nearly trip on something that's covered in grass. It turns out to be a small sign that reads, Dude Creek Critical Habitat Area. The only indicator you're anywhere special.
I need some trimming. This isn't symbolic like I'm cleaning the headstone in the cemetery, and this is the cemetery.
After he finishes clearing out the weeds, DeBeer smiles. He's not ready to go into mourning yet. He thinks, he hopes, this habitat should be around for a long time. He would just like a guarantee on that. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
You can find the leaked Fish and Game documents, a longer version of this story, and pictures of Dude Creek at alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, honoring Alaska World War II vets with a trip to a Washington, D.C. memorial.
The real value is just what you see here, families interacting. They're seeing this for the first time. The families are hearing stories for the first time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. As More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The annual Alaska Federation of Natives Convention wrapped up Saturday in Fairbanks. AFN board co-chairs were elected in the morning. Anna Hoffman garnered the most votes. Hoffman is the president and CEO of the Bethel Native Corporation. She will serve with Arctic Slope Regional Corporation External Affairs Vice President Tara Sweeney. In thanking the AFN delegates for their votes, Hoffman noted the significance of the election results.
I look forward to serving as co-chair with Tara Sweeney, a fellow ANCSCA afterborn, and the first time AFN has two women co-chairs.
Sweeney will serve a one-year term and Hoffman will serve for 2 years. Resolutions dealing with a wide range of issues, from health and safety to land rights and subsistence protection, took up the afternoon. Special recognition resolutions honoring Katie John and Native actor Ray Mala were also passed. A group of people assembled for AFN rallied Saturday in support of four Native men they believe are wrongly imprisoned for murder. George Fries, Eugene Vent, Marvin Roberts, and Kevin Pease are serving long sentences for the 1997 beating of Fairbanks teen John Hartman. The so-called Fairbanks 4 case jumped to center stage last month when the Alaska Innocence Project filed requests for post-conviction relief based on new information showing others are responsible. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the call for their exoneration took on a broader voice at the weekend rally.
The ralliers banged drums, sang songs, and waved signs in solidarity with the Fairbanks Four. Native American rock star Robbie Romero of New Mexico joined Alaska Natives in support of the jailed men.
I'm honored to be here with you today, and I'm honored to stand up and speak out for these four men who have been falsely incarcerated. Oh.
Romero encouraged a peaceful approach, a sentiment echoed by Athabascan David Solomon, who warned ralliers not to let anger about what's happened dictate their actions.
We have to do it in a good way. Don't let the white man track you, make you go off the wrong track to be off the Native in jail. We do it in a loving way, in a good way.
Another speaker, David Harrison of the village of Chickaloon, called on Alaska tribes and villages to come together to free the Fairbanks Four.
If we continue to struggle as one village or one tribe, we're not going to go anywhere. But if we assert as nations, things will change.
Saturday's rally was staged outside the Carlson Center, where Alaska Federation of Natives Convention delegates unanimously passed a resolution in support of re-examination of evidence in the Fairbanks 4 case to see that justice is done. The resolution was submitted by the Tanana Chiefs Conference, which has offered a reward for information leading to exoneration of the men. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Climate change is causing Arctic sea ice to melt rapidly and recede, opening up vast stretches of Arctic waters for shipping and resource development. In response, a group of state legislators and others is working on a policy they hope will help shape Alaska's policy for managing those changes and influence the federal government's broader national Arctic policy. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Members of the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission met in Fairbanks last week in their fourth and final public session on developing recommendations on responding to changes that will come as the sea ice goes away. Commission co-chair Liesl McGuire says both Alaska and the United States are rushing to catch up with seven other Arctic nations that already have policies in place on dealing with such issues as increased shipping and more offshore oil and gas development in newly opened Arctic waters.
The federal government was the last to come to the table. And I would say that Alaska is certainly late to the table as well. But better late than never.
McGuire is a Republican state senator from Anchorage, and she says the commission has been working on the policy since it was formed by the legislature in the spring. She says the commission's work will take many forms and affect Alaskans in many ways by creating the basis for state laws and policies to deal with climate change.
There are a variety of ways that it will impact Alaskans. The first, of course, is its impact on Alaska law. The area of Arctic drilling, for example, and how the policy will be carried out with respect to the balance between the ecosystem management and drilling.
McGuire says the state policy is intended to influence federal Arctic policy on such issues as increased shipping through the Bering Strait from the Northwest Passage along Canada's Arctic coast and the Northern Sea Route along Russia's northern coast.
The vessels that are now going through that are from Russia, they are from parts of Europe, Norway, China.
McGuire says the commission supports a stepped-up Coast Guard presence throughout the Alaskan Arctic to monitor shipping and respond to emergencies. She says the Coast Guard's selection of Port Clarence at the tip of the Seward Peninsula for an expanded base of operations is a big step in that direction. The Alaska Arctic policy would encourage a greater state role in developing deep water ports and other infrastructure, with financing arranged through agencies such as the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. The Commission's recommendations also cite the need for increased federal management of the very productive fisheries off western Alaska and protection of Alaska Natives' subsistence fishing and whaling rights. One of the commissioners represents the federal government. He's Pat Pershaw, a special assistant to the Secretary of the Interior. Pershaw says the feds welcome Alaska's input on the national Arctic policy.
That the state wants a role in some of these things that affect the nation and Alaska. And there ought to be room for that.
And one commissioner represents conservation interests. She's Layla Hughes, a lawyer and former consultant for the World Wildlife Fund. Hughes says she believes her fellow commissioners have been receptive to her input, so far anyway.
I think that in general the commission is open to recommendations from my constituents, and we'll see how it goes once we actually get to the stage of making the recommendations.
McGuire says the commission's recommendations will be integrated into a preliminary report that will be submitted to the legislature early next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by photographer Brian Adams, with the opening of his exhibit and the release of his new book, I Am Alaskan, An Exploration of Identity, at the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, 5 p.m. Friday, November 1st.
An estimated 1,500 World War II veterans live in Alaska. The generation that fought Nazis and the Imperial Japanese Army are now in their 80s and 90s. A group dedicated to honoring these Alaskans, the Last Frontier Honor Flight, flew 24 veterans to Washington, D.C. last week to visit the World War II Memorial. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Most of the 25 vets arrived at the memorial wearing blue and yellow windbreakers with Alaska emblazoned on the back. But not Mike Hunt. The 91-year-old aviator stood out in his original Air Corps uniform and leather bomber jacket.
It's the original uniform. This jacket was issued to me in Long Beach, California in 1942. And the reason I still got it is I hung it in my chicken house after the war. And my son retrieved it and wiped the mold off of it, put bear grease on it, and here it is. It still fits.
During the war, Hunt flew aircraft to Russian pilots at Ladd Field in Fairbanks, hauled supplies over the hump in the Himalayas, and delivered troops to occupied Japan. Then he homesteaded in East Anchorage. Like most of the others on the trip, he toured the memorial in a borrowed wheelchair. As the group rolled toward the central fountain for a group photo, a passing jogger stopped to shake hands and thank them for their service. When Hunt looks back on the war, he thinks of how the whole country pulled together to win it, and of those who never made it home.
All these heroes here sacrificed so that we're all free. I feel fortunate that I'm still here as a survivor. Could have been the other way around.
Most of the Alaska honorees came with a family member, in Hunt's case, his son, Howard. Together, they looked at one of the memorial's more subtle features, a series of panels around the perimeter that depict scenes of the war and of the home front.
Probably the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Ah.
So this is the beginning of the war. And it goes down. Each relief has got a different image, from enlistment to training to service to shipping out, and then coming, fighting the war, and then coming back home.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
It goes from the beginning to the end.
A lot of thought went into that.
Among the Alaska vets were two elders from Metlakatla and two women.
It's a real thrill to come with this group. It's a real honor.
Ellen Jean White of Anchorage spent more than two decades in the Air Force. She joined the war effort hoping to serve her country as a pilot.
Well, I went in 1944. I tried to get in WASPs, and they wouldn't let me in because I was a quarter inch too short. And I had a pilot's license, and I was fully qualified otherwise. So I joined the Air Force, and I wanted something to do with aviation, and they made me an admin clerk, and finally I got into aircraft maintenance, and then they took us, they wouldn't let us be that very long because they said it wasn't ladylike. So then I went into supply, and I was in supply and logistics from then on.
After the war, White was twice stationed at Elmendorf, and she retired in Anchorage in the 1970s. Still agile at 92, she popped in and out of her wheelchair to pose for pictures with her granddaughter. Last Frontier Honor Flight, along with its Fairbanks sister organization, raised money to fly the veterans to Washington. Founder and President Ron Travis of Big Lake is a Vietnam War veteran.
Well, the real value is just what you see here, families interacting. They're seeing this for the first time. The families are hearing stories for the first time. And I think it's kind of a closure somewhat to some of the veterans, that when they look around and it's kind of an ending thing for them, you know, it's kind of shut the door because it never really got shut. So to me, that's what is really what it's kind of about.
Travis says he hopes this is the first tour of many. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Gustavus and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Many Alaskans are choosing to make energy efficiency improvements around their homes. Investing in efficient light bulbs or a programmable thermostat could save hundreds annually. For more tips on how to save money and energy, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.